Adult Shoes. Recorded live.
All right, everyone. Welcome to the James Madison Community Call. This is the ninth day of July in the year 2013. And we are graciously blessed with the presence of our guest this evening, one Gary Hart, who is here to speak with us and teach us a little bit about the subject of habeas corpus. And I'm very thankful. I tried to get some time this week, which I was unsuccessful in, to be able to look into this a little bit more with some of the information that Gary had given me for research purposes. And so I haven't been able to do any of the research. So I'm like all the rest of you, I'm having to count on what Gary has done to try to bring me up to speed. Of course, we will all look into this afterwards once we have all the data and the links and the information and where it's found. And Gary is always very, very prudent to give us, the documentary proof of what he brings forward. So I think that's important to bear in mind as we listen to what he has to say and he shares with us his experiences in his research and that and what he has learned. I don't want to go on too far. If you want to, Gary, you've been on before, and I think people, most folks anyway, probably know you pretty well. But maybe there are a few newbies on that haven't listened to you before. So if you want to give a little an introduction or something there before you head on into your study of habeas corpus, that would be cool. I'll leave that up to you. However you want to conduct it, but I'm turning it over to you right now. It's yours.
Okay. What made me a patriot? Well, see, I was served in Vietnam. I was a volunteer in Vietnam. When I got back, I got involved in the anti-war movement. When the war was over, I went about life. And then in 1981, I had a little run-in with the Internal Revenue Service. Seems they would bail out New York and Chrysler that year, but they wouldn't bail me out, and they closed my office and kind of got me upset over things. They stole my entire bank account. It was only $9,000, but I couldn't pay my employees. And so I had to go start collecting money from clients so I could pay my employees and keep my business open and pay them a little bit more so I could get my office back. They handcuffed the doors with these covers over the knobs. So I started looking at the Internal Revenue Service matter, the income tax matter, which back then was probably the paramount patriot issue, income tax. By 1984, I had learned enough about income tax, and I was onto something that was a little bit different than most of the programs out there, and it had to do with my relationship with the Internal Revenue Service. The question is, am I a taxpayer? My answer is no, and it served me since 1985 very effectively in not paying income taxes, even though I did work for other people for over 20 years, or about, well, not over 20. I had my own business back then. I had my own business until 93. And I've worked for other people from 96 until about 4 years ago when I retired. But the government basically pushed me into a realm. You know, they say that marijuana is the gateway drug. It gets you close to heroin. Well, I did marijuana. I never did heroin. But income tax back then was the gateway drug to patriotism. I had my own business in 92. Two, I had an idea. I'm going to start a patriot newspaper. I'd been doing a lot of research. I worked with Richard McDonald in Southern California about state citizenship, which I fully believe in. I think Richard's research was phenomenal. I went out and spent a couple of weeks with him in California. And then Waco came up. And when Waco came up, after Waco, I went to Waco. I was there most of the siege. And after I left Waco, there were people all over the country asking me to come and tell what happened in Waco. So I pretty much shut my business doors. Gary DeHunt Professional Land Surveyor was the business. And traveled around for a couple of years. In the meantime, got married again and had a couple daughters. And so in 95, middle of 95, I settled down and went back to work in Phoenix, Arizona. Did not pay income taxes there. Filled out the W-4 and said exempt or whatever you have to write in that little box. And it was no problem at all. And a number of other places I've worked since then, the same thing. But I've continued to write since Waco to the Patriot community during the years I was traveling. It was primarily by fax network, and after I settled down, it was by fax for a while. And then I guess about 96, somewhere there, or 97, I went online and started Outpost, what evolved into outpost-of-freedom.com, which is my webpage. And when I provide links, they'll be referring to that. And I've continued to write, slowed down for a few years, but in 2006, 2007, when the economy started falling apart, things picked back up. But let's go back to 1995 and habeas corpus. I was charged with, before Waco, I was charged with driving my motorcycle without a license and without tags on the motorcycle. My first appearance, I tried to plead guilty, and the judge said, "Why are you pleading guilty?" And I said, "Well, you know, I spent over an hour here now. I can't afford to plead not guilty." So he entered a plea of not guilty for me. This is before Waco. Then I went to Waco, and I asked for an extension. The state had already asked for an extension before I went to Waco. I, from Waco, asked for an extension. They sent me a form to be notarized and sent back, but I crossed out a few things that were giving up my rights, and so they didn't accept and grant me the extension. So I was in and out of Florida for the next couple of years and get arrested, bail out, and have to go somewhere and miss the next appearance. I think it went three cycles like that. But I was back there in early 95, and I got arrested. And so in, I think it was March, I went to court. And the night before court, I was looking on Richard McDonald's bulletin board, and there was a chat in there between he and another fellow, and they were talking about habeas corpus. And I still didn't have an idea what it was exactly, but, you know, I kind of looked at that and said, you know, this is interesting. And I know that everybody then was that was going to court wanted to find out how to get into common law court. So the night before, I'm thinking, I don't want to get into common law court. I want to get out of common law court. Now, if I want to get out of common law court, when I get to court, I have to assume that I'm in common law court. So I went to court the next morning, and some young girl comes up to me and said, "Are you Mr. Hunt?" And I said, "Yes, I am." She said, "I'm your court-appointed attorney." And I said, "I don't need a court-appointed attorney. I speak on my own behalf in this matter. However, if you want to, you're welcome to listen in." And then my name came up, and I had planned what I was going to do, what my approach was, but it required that that I object to the proceedings. And I tried three or four times to object, and the judge kept talking. He'd set a jury trial date, I think for June or July. He wanted to fret of me, and if you want to ask me some questions, go ahead, and if I want to answer, I'll answer the questions. And finally, I got it in. I object to these proceedings. Now, an objection is supposed to stop everything until the objection's overruled or sustained, dealt with. I object to these proceedings. I am the moving party today. I set forth this demand for habeas corpus. I cannot find an injured party. I need this court to direct the sheriff to bring forward the injured party with a sworn affidavit as to the injury. If this is civil rather than criminal, I need the sheriff to bring forward the injured party with the original contract, which I'm alleged to be party to and in violation of. And the judge says, "Well, I still have to ask you some questions." And I said, "Mr. Marblestone, are you suspending habeas corpus?" He looked at the prosecutor and he said, "Are you sure you can find a witness to put Mr. Hunt on the motorcycle back then?" "Well, it might be difficult." Now, wait, they'd already set jury trial date, so they must have scheduled the officer. Anyway, the judge then said, "Would the state consider a null pros?" State would consider a null pros. "Would you put that in the form of a motion?" State moves to null pros. granted, get out of my courtroom. Now, from when I said, Mr. Marblestone, are you suspending the Constitution, to my walking out the door of the courtroom, a free man, it was about 19 seconds. It went that quickly. So I knew it was on to something, and I intended to go back and research habeas corpus more, but other things and moving to Arizona and getting settled and then working for a living, that was all put aside. But I figured if I ever got charged by the federal government with a crime, I'd look into it then. And a little over a year ago, well, in 1997, I testified for one of the defendants in what was called the Florida Common Law Court Trial. Emilio Ippolito, Susan Mockdad, Toby Brown, Phil Marsh, Doug Carpa, and others. I don't remember the other names. Now, one of the people was not there at the time. His name was Larry Myers. He had fled the state, so he was the only one that did not stand trial. I testified for Toby Brown as a witness. Toby was the only one that represented himself. Everybody else had an attorney, and Toby was the only one that was acquitted. Now, that brought accusations against Toby because he was acquitted, but I think that the jury had no choice because the IRS undercover agent, Robert Chapman, who went by, whose real name was Robert Quigley, lied. He flat out lied. My testimony undermined his testimony, and the jury apparently accepted my testimony, so Toby was acquitted over his part in this thing. About a little over a year ago, a lady from Texas called me, and she said, you're Gary Hunt, you know about the Ippolito trial in 97. And I said, yes. She said, my brother is Larry Myers. They've arrested him. Can you help him? And I said, I don't know what I could do. You know, I'm familiar with the trial because I testified in it. Then I decided, you know, government hasn't, in these all these years, the government has never charged me with anything. And so maybe I'll never get a chance to try the habeas corpus. So I said, look, I'll try, but here's what I'm going to do, habeas corpus, and explained it briefly to her. She said, you know, we would appreciate it. And I don't think I ever met Larry Myers. Now, you'll hear me refer to him as Larry Michael Myers because he wants his middle name out there. It's M-I-C-K-I-E-L, or M-I-K-I-E-L, Larry Michael Myers, M-Y-E-R-S. And so decided that should be the style of the case for the habeas corpus. So I prepared a habeas corpus, got it to him before court. Now, habeas corpus, interestingly, is two things. You can challenge jurisdiction, and you can challenge the constitutionality of laws. And we'll get into that, and I'll give you the cites and everything, the quotes and the cites for this. So I prepared a quick habeas corpus. I think it was two or three pages. I sent it to Larry, told him to serve the jailers if they wouldn't take it, to send it through the, you know, it had to go through the prison mail system or jail mail system, send it to the sheriff. That was done a couple weeks prior to trial. Now, like an objection, that habeas corpus had to be responded to before they could proceed with the trial. So the trial I had really is of no consequence. By the way, anybody that wants to read about the 95 habeas corpus, that's a link I just put in. He served them. He went to trial. It was a very short trial. The first one was very long. Same charges, very short trial. He was convicted. And everybody else got 12 years, I think, back in 97. I think he got 7 or 9 years. He got a little lesser. But at any rate, you know, the judge, Meriday, who, same judge, and Peluso was the prosecutor, same prosecutor that were there in 97, were there in 2012. I don't know if they came out of retirement or not. I do know that Peluso got an award from Janet Napolitano, or no, Janet Reno back then. Janet Reno for getting the conviction in the Florida common law case. I had the article, and he got an award for getting that conviction. That's how important it is to the government to go after these people that challenge the system. At any rate, Larry went to trial, and about that time, then I started preparing a more lengthy habeas corpus. I think it ended up being about 15 pages at this point, a lot more detailed because these people weren't paying attention. I sent it to the judge. I sent it to the sheriff. I sent it to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and I sent it to the Florida Supreme Court. The judge never responded. The sheriff never responded. The Court of Appeals referenced Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure Rule 22, which said that if they got habeas corpus, they're supposed to send it down to the district court, but instead they sent it back to me, so they ignored their own rules. And the Florida Supreme Court, after a few iterations and correspondence, they finally said it's out of our jurisdiction. So the next stop was the United States Supreme Court, and I think it was November of last year when it finally went to the Supreme Court. Now, we'll pick up there a little later, but let's go into what habeas corpus is. And this is what I've developed in the last 20 months that I've been working on this. Habeas corpus has a long history. It was referred to as the sacred writ. In fact, in Black's Law Dictionary, habeas corpus ad subjicendum is recognized as the sacred writ. Now, there are, I think, 8 habeas corpuses in Black's Law Dictionary, and all of the others are appellate challenges or transfers from one jurisdiction to another, but only the one, habeas corpus ad subjicendum, is the one that, well, I'll read what Black says about it. A writ directed to the person detaining another and commanding them to produce the body of the prisoner or person detained. This is the most common form of habeas corpus writ, the purpose of which is to test the legality of the detention or imprisonment, not whether he is guilty or innocent. This is the well-known remedy in England and the United States for deliverance from illegal confinement, called by Sir William Blackstone the most celebrated writ in the English law and the great nefacious writ in all manner of illegal confinement, the great writ of liberty, issuing at common law out of the courts of chancery. So, when the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, Clause 2, the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in case of rebellion or invasion the public safety may require it. Well, wait, that said privilege. It didn't say right. So, you know, first step, what do you mean by privilege instead of right? Well, a privilege is a right that is subject to suspension. The Bill of Rights, the Second Amendment, is not subject to suspension. The First Amendment is not subject to suspension. Habeas corpus is, but only in cases of rebellion or invasion where the public safety may require it. So it is a right as strong as any other right, and only the legislative branch of government can suspend habeas corpus. But wait, I had a sheriff, a district court judge, an appellate court, and a Florida Supreme Court basically suspend habeas corpus by not dealing with it. You know, if they don't deal with it, they've suspended it. It ceases to operate, and that's suspending it. So let's go further into what habeas corpus is. Here's where it goes way back. The first Habeas Corpus Act was in England, obviously, in 1679. And I'm just going to read a portion that the officers who fail to recognize the habeas corpus, quote, shall neglect or refuse to make the returns aforesaid, shall for the first offense forfeit the prisoner or party grieved the sum of £100. Damn, they have to pay the guy £100. That's a lot of money, by the way, in England. And for the second offense, the sum of £200 and is hereby made incapable to hold or execute his said office. That's the punishment in 1679 if the officers of the court or those detaining people failed to comply with the Habeas Corpus Act. Now, in 1768, William Blackstone, in his commentaries, talked about habeas corpus. This is a high prerogative writ, and therefore, by the common law, issuing out of the court of the King's Bench, not only in term time, but also during the vacation, may by fiat from the Chief Justice or any other judges, and running into all parts of the King's dominions, for the King is at all times entitled to have an account why the liberty of any of his subjects is restrained wherever that restraint may be inflicted. Now, substitute people. The people at all times are entitled to have an account why the liberty of any of the people is restrained wherever that restraint may be inflicted, because we're no longer a monarchy. I think that we have to substitute us as the in lieu of the king. Further in Blacks, he says, in the court of the king's bench, it was and still is still necessary to apply for it by motion to the court, as in the case of all other prerogative writs. For as was argued by the Lord Chief Justice Vaughan, quote, it is granted on motion because it cannot be had of course, and therefore is no necessity to grant it, for the court ought to be satisfied that the party hath a probable cause to be delivered. What he just said is, when you ask for habeas corpus, they have to get it because you have probable cause to believe it. So it will be challenged. There is no dispute when you submit habeas corpus. It has to be considered and addressed. It stops everything else until it's done. If a probable ground be shown that the party is imprisoned without just cause and therefore hath a right to be delivered, the writ of habeas corpus is then a writ of right, which may not be denied but ought to be granted to every man that is committed or detained in prison or otherwise restrained, though it be by the command of the king, the privy council, or any other, that being why they were detained. So even if the king detained somebody, he had the right to habeas corpus. Further on, he says, it was shown to be a natural inherent right. And he further, he says, and though sometimes a little impaired by the ferocity of the times, and this is the reason for habeas corpus, asserted that and confirmed by the conqueror himself and his descendants, that though the sometimes a little impaired by the ferocity of the times and the occasional despotism of jealous or usurping princes, so these are the people that might erroneously imprison you. Further, he says, this induces an absolute necessity of expressing upon every commitment the reason for which it is made, that the court upon an habeas corpus may examine into its validity and, according to the circumstances of the case, may discharge, admit to bail, or remand the prisoner. So the court can discharge him, put him out on bail, or remand him back to the detention and trial, subsequent trial. So those are the three choices of the court, but they have to deal with it. Further, he says, he said the ferocity of the times and the occasional despotism or jealous or usurping princesses. So remember that. This is why they had habeas corpus, because jealous or usurping, obviously taking a power they don't have, princesses. William Raw, a constitutional scholar in 1829, this is based on the United States Constitution. In fact, the book was A View of the Constitution of the United States. And talking about habeas corpus, it is the great remedy of the citizen or subject against arbitrary or illegal imprisonment. It is the mode by which the judicial power speedily and effectually protects the personal liberty of every individual and repels the injustice of unconstitutional laws or despotic governors. Unconstitutional laws or despotic governors. And it also, they said in there, speedily and effectually. Now, I've been working on this habeas corpus for 16 months now. That's not very speedy or effectual either. After erecting the distant government which we are considering and after declaring what should constitute the supreme law in every state in the Union, fearful minds might entertain jealousies of this great and all-controlling power, if some protection against its energies when misdirected was not provided by itself. Now, he's saying that government can do almost anything they want if we didn't have the sacred writ. If this provision had been omitted, the existing powers under the state governments, none of whom are without it, might be questioned and a person imprisoned on a mandate of the president or other officer under color of lawful authority derived from the United States might be denied relief. So, see, a state can challenge the federal government. In fact, when we get into the cases, you'll find occurrences of that. But the state courts and judges possess the right of determining on the legality of imprisonment under either authority. So Rawls and the people back then honestly believed that a state could challenge the federal authority constitutionality of federal law only through the court. Now, remember, the Constitution has no provision for a state to nullify a law. We've got the Kentucky resolves and various instruments in our history that are not law. But what I read you, 192 in the Constitution, is a way for people to nullify unconstitutional law. So nullification, in accordance with the Constitution, and let's see, Article the 10th Amendment. You've heard of the 10th Amendment, Senators. The power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, comma, nor prohibited by it to the states, comma, are reserved to the states respectively, comma, or to the people. Now, that or to the people, the last part of the 10th Amendment, says that we can nullify them. It supports the concept of habeas corpus. Next, we go to Justice Joseph Story, Commentaries on the Constitution from 1833. In order to understand the meaning of the terms here used, it will be necessary to have the recourse to the common law, for in no other way can we arrive at the true definition of the writ of habeas corpus. At the common law, there are various writs called writs of habeas corpus, but the particular one here spoken of is the great and celebrated writ used in all cases of illegal confinement, known by the name of the writ of habeas corpus ad subjiciendum. It is therefore justly esteemed the great bulwark of personal liberty. Remember, they didn't fight for freedom back then. They fought for liberty. And this is the great bulwark of personal liberty, since it is the appropriate remedy to ascertain whether any person is rightfully in confinement or not, and the cause of his confinement, and if no sufficient ground of detention appears, the party is entitled to his immediate discharge. So that's the background of habeas corpus in authoritative writings early in our history, and some of it predating the history of the United States. So we get a picture of this way of challenging, you know, if you charge me with a crime and you're the government, and the Constitution does not give you the authority to charge me with that crime. Now, going back 20, 30 years, once you start becoming a patriot, somewhere along the line, you'll look at the Constitution, you'll talk with other people about it, and you'll see that there's very few crimes in the Constitution. Let's see, piracy, counterfeiting, treason. There's a few others, I think. There's four or five crimes explicit, and there are others where the government is given the authority to address certain things like copyrights and trademarks and things like that, certain rights. They have the right to protect those rights. But as far as punishing crimes, we're down to four or five, and they're pretty basic. Now, the Florida Constitution, I refer to Florida because this whole thing began. The Florida Constitution says this about habeas corpus. It's Article 1, the Declaration of Rights, Section 13. Habeas corpus, the writ of habeas corpus shall be grantable of right freely and without cost. It shall be returnable without delay and shall never be suspended unless in case of rebellion or invasion. Suspension is essential to the public safety. So they are actually a little bit stronger than the federal constitution. So now we're going to have to kind of deviate away from habeas corpus for a few minutes, even though we will be talking about habeas corpus. But we have to understand what our relationship with the federal government was. And we're going to start out in 1833. So we, now, I wrote a story, the Habeas Corpus, the Guardian of Liberty, and I think we've got the link posted in the chat. In that, you'll see all these references. They're brought up in that article. The federal government and us, the Freeman movement in Montana, the sovereign citizen, all these are kind of half right. We have to look at it, and this is, well, first, you have to take your preconceptions and misconceptions about our relationship with government and about our habeas corpus and get them out of your mind and pay attention. When you're done, you can get those back in and weigh them against what you're going to hear. But our relationship with the federal government is almost non-existent. We authorized it to exist for a certain purpose. The purpose is generally laid out in the preamble of the Constitution and specifically laid out in the Constitution itself. And in that Constitution, certain powers and authorities were granted to the federal government. And anything not granted to the federal government was not granted to the federal government. I read the 10th Amendment, retained by the states or the people. Now, to be a member of the union, you have to have a constitution. There were a couple exceptions early on. Rhode Island and Connecticut, I think. Two states just revised their charters, but the others all created constitutions. And any state coming into the union after the ratification of the constitution had to have a constitution in place first. Now, that constitution is a relinquishment by the people of that state of certain rights to the federal government to be done, or the state government to be done collectively. We give them the right to do these certain things, and that's all we give them. Now, we're talking habeas corpus only in regard to the federal government during the course of this program, but it applies to the states as well. Did we give them the right to do something? If not, they don't have a right to do it. We have retained those rights. Likewise, the federal government was given powers and authorities, and that's what we gave them, and we have retained the others. Some were enumerated. One was the right of habeas, the privilege of habeas corpus, the Bill of Rights. There are a number of elements in there that are restrictive on the government and permissive on the state. So it was a contract between the states and the federal government under the authority of the people. So let's look at, this is Barron versus City of Baltimore, 1833. For a site, it is 32 U.S. 243. And the U.S. means it was a Supreme Court decision. This is from that case. The Constitution was ordained and established by the people of the United States for themselves and for their own government, and not for the government of the individual states. Each state established a constitution for itself, and in that constitution provided such limitations and restrictions on the powers of its particular government as its judgment dictated. The powers they conferred on this government, the federal, were to be exercised by itself, and the state, and the limitations on power expressed in general terms are naturally, and we think necessarily, applicable to the government created by the instrument. If these propositions are correct, the Fifth Amendment must be understood as restraining the power of the general government, that's the federal government, not as applicable to the state. Well, the Fifth Amendment then only applied to the federal government, not to the state. Fifth Amendment won't let land be taken without due process of law. What happened in Barron's case is Barron had a wharf in Baltimore. The state or the city, came in and did some dredging. And when they did the dredging, they piled a lot of the waste material in front of his dock, and he could not get ships in. His dock was no good anymore. He got no remedy from the city, no remedy from the state, so he went to the federal government and said, they did not compensate me for the land they took from me when they took away my right to use my dock as a dock. All I can get is little sailboats in there now. I can't get ships in there. And the federal government said the federal constitution, Article 4, is a prohibition of the general government, the federal government, from acting on me. It does not protect you from the state government because the state people of the state created their own constitution, and they decided what would be in that and what would not be in it. Now, do we begin to see a distinction here that the federal government does not act upon me? Now, it'll come in later, but at this point, this is how it started out. Further on, he says, if the original Constitution in the 9th and 10th sections of the first article, which are the grants to the state and prohibitions to the state, draws this plain and marked line of discrimination between the limitations it imposes on the powers of the general government and on those of the state, those are the only areas where these things may cross over, and they were defined in Article 1, Sections 9 and 10. So the federal government did not act on, did not protect us from the state government, only from the federal government. More, that's an inch. When I say get rid of the preconceptions, that's hard to swallow, especially when they demonized the Montana Freeman back then, because they said federal laws don't apply to me. Well, I believe that. Federal laws don't apply to me. And I think I'm right. I believe that for a long time, but my research now, when I went to these cases on habeas corpus and I did extensive search trying to find cases that would support the argument that I've presented to the United States Supreme Court. When they talk about the amendments, these amendments demanded security against the apprehended encroachments of the general government and not against those of local government. Remember, we had 13 colonies, and they were afraid the federal government was going to take over. They were going to, you know, just take over the whole thing. Patrick Henry spoke against it. A lot of people spoke against it because of that. These amendments, is intended solely as a limitation on the exercise of the power of the government of the United States and is not applicable to the legislation of the states. So the reason for the federal constitution was to bring these groups together in a federation, but the federal government did not act on them because it was strictly a protective instrument. So except for those enumerated crimes in the Constitution, it doesn't act on us. Next case, many of you may be familiar with, and this is the one that some people challenge it. I think that it's probably right. Marbury versus Madison, 5 U.S. 137. It was 1803. And he said, an act of the legislature repugnant to the Constitution is void. If it's repugnant to the Constitution, it's void. So if they enact a law that's unconstitutional and it's proven to be unconstitutional, it's void. But interestingly, even before the United States Constitution, in 1787 in North Carolina, this case is Bayard, B-A-Y-A-R-D, versus Singleton. It's 1 North Carolina 42. It was the 42nd case held by the dealt with by the North Carolina Supreme Court. And they're talking about a law. What this one has to do with is the property of Tories. The Constitution prohibited taking property. It had kind of a Fourth Amendment provision in it. The legislature then comes along and passes a law and said, no, a Tory comes back to North Carolina and he cannot get his property back. And so the Tory that came back challenged it to the North Carolina Supreme Court, and the court said, but that it was clear that no act that they could pass, meaning the legislature of North Carolina, could by any means repeal or alter the Constitution, because if they could do this, alter the Constitution, they would at the same instant of time destroy their own existence as a legislature and dissolve the government thereby established. Now, those are pretty profound. If they enforce something after the Supreme Court says, no, you can't do it, and they try and enforce it, what they have done is voided the contract that created that legislative body and the entire government of North Carolina. That's pretty much what Marshall said, except this one got punitive by saying the government disappeared at the same time that the law came into place. So the next case in this series of cases that lead to the conclusions that we'll get to had to do with slavery. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 was enacted in 1850. And it was a set of rules that dictated what somebody had to do and providing penalty if they didn't in returning slaves to their rightful owners. Now, some people have challenged the Fugitive Slave Act as unconstitutional, and we'll get there in a minute, but this case is Abelman, A-B-L-E-M-A-N, v. Booth, B-O-O-T-H, 62 U.S. 506, and it's an 1858 case. Justice Taney gave the decision of the court. In the first case, it provides that this Constitution and the laws of the United States will be made pursuant thereof, shall be the supreme law of the land and obligatory upon the judges in every state. The sovereignty to be created was to be limited in its powers of legislation, and if it passed a law not authorized by its enumerated powers, it was not to be regarded as the supreme law of the land, nor were the state judges bound to carry it into execution. Well, that makes sense. If it wasn't within the authority of the Constitution, it was law not authorized by its enumerated powers, It was not to be regarded as the supreme law of the land, but also to guard the states from any encroachment upon their reserve rights by the general government, if it appears that an act of Congress is not pursuant to and within the limits of the power assigned to the federal government, it is the duty of the courts of the United States to declare it unconstitutional and void. But then he goes into the Fugitive Slave Act, and people say, well, even today people tell me that Fugitive Slave Act was unconstitutional. However, if we look at Article 4, Section 2, Section 2, Clauses 2 and 3, which I'll find in just a second. In all cases, that's not right. Wrong one. Yeah, it is. From those. A person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime who shall flee from justice and be found in another state shall, on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled, be delivered up to and be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime. And in Clause 3, no person held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof, escaping into another state, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from some service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. So those were both in the Constitution. So the Fugitive Slave Act was simply a codification. It was a codification and dealt with the detail of how to deal with fleeing slaves. Abelman was hiding slaves. He was arrested by a U.S. Marshal. The Wisconsin Supreme Court heard the case. Went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court with habeas corpus. They said, no, it's not a constitutional law. It went on error up to the United States Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, then Taney, ruled on this and showed that it was constitutional because its constitutional nexus was Article, 3, Clause 2, Article 3, Section 2, Clauses 2 and 3. It says they have to be returned, and so, you know, it's constitutional. What can I say? 13 years later, in state of Wisconsin again, in 1871, had another case came up, and this had to do with a guy named Edward Tarple. He was under the age of 18. He was a minor, but he enlisted as a soldier under the name of Frank Brown. Later, he deserted and was retaken and confined as a deserter. His father then went to the Wisconsin Supreme Court and, with the habeas corpus, got his son released. Then it was taken by one of the federal officers to the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court again showed the constitutional nexus, and this is where it's important. There are within the territorial limits of each state two governments restricted in their spheres of action, but independent of each other and supreme within their respective spheres. Neither government can intrude within the jurisdiction or authorize any interference therein by its judicial officers with the actions of the others. Now, the question is there authority for them to retain Tarple? Well, the Constitution recognizes that the military comes under the President of the United States, that he's the supreme commander of the military. So whether Tarple was a minor or not was inconsequential. The fact that he enlisted and did not say, look, I'm underage, let me out, but he deserted, he violated military law. And so the federal government at that point assumed, based on the constitutional nexus of the authorities granted to the president and the Congress regarding military, that they had jurisdiction over Tarple. So Wisconsin's Supreme Court was overturned one more time because the constitutional nexus existed. There was justification in the Constitution specifically that gave the federal government, the authority to expound upon the authority of the Constitution and make laws dealing with deserters that had enlisted. He may have gotten out if he'd gone and said, look, I'm not old enough, but instead he deserted, and that was it. And now he's subject to I don't think they had UCMJ back then, but he's subject to the military laws at that point, even though it was after the Civil War. So those are the cases that predate the 14th Amendment, and we can see the relationship that if there is no constitutional nexus between the person and the law, or the law and the Constitution that affect a person, there's no nexus, there's no law. If there is a nexus, as there was in Abelman v. Booth and Henry Tarbell, then the law is valid. But we saw that the Constitution didn't protect anybody from the state under the Fourth Amendment. So then we come to the 14th Amendment. United States versus Reese, 1875 decision. This is not a habeas corpus case, but this has to do with nexus. This kind of confirms what I said about nexus, but the other side of it. What if the nexus doesn't exist? The 15th Amendment reads, the right of citizens of the United States, this is after the 14th, citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any states on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So the right to vote cannot be denied. 15th Amendment. First time the federal government got into the voting issue, but they did it. Then came the Enrollment Act of 1870, which was the law written like the Fugitive Slave Act, theoretically, on the 15th Amendment, the authority granted by the 15th Amendment. But Section 3 of that Enrollment Act says that whenever any act is or shall be required to be done by any citizen as a prerequisite to qualify or entitle him to vote. Now, it says nothing about race in there. The authority of the 15th had to do with race, color, or previous condition of servitude, and they don't mention any of those in Section 3. And then we go to the Section 4, and it says, if any person by force, bribery, threats, intimidation, or other unlawful means shall hinder, delay, or prevent, or obstruct, or shall combine and confederate with others to hinder, delay, prevent, or obstruct any citizen from doing any act required to be done to qualify him to vote or from voting at any election, as aforesaid. But again, they didn't talk about race, color, or previous condition of servitude. So the court overturned those two sections of the Enrollment Act of 1870 because the nexus, the 15th Amendment, did not give them the authority to be as broad as they were. If they had confined Sections 3 and 4 to race, color, or previous condition of servitude, there would have been a constitutional nexus. They would have been valid under the Constitution. But on the contrary, they didn't include that wording, and as such, then the people that were charged for violating the Enrollment Act were released. There was no valid law for them to abide by. So that's the other side of what we heard in Abelman v. Booth and Henry Tarpel. This is when the nexus doesn't exist, the people were released. Now, it did not go via habeas corpus. It was just fought out in the regular court system. So, you got any questions at this point, Mr. Madison? James? Oh, I don't know where
you are. Well, I'm sorry. I had muted myself out. So, you know, I didn't want any background noise going on there. But no, I've just been absorbing all this, and this is just wonderful. I mean, see if there's anyone on the chat window wants to kick in. West Iowa is on mute. If you have a question, you're welcome to bring it forward.
Anybody have any questions then? Now, we'll give me a breather and let you talk. Somebody else talk for at least a few seconds.
Sure, not a problem. Well, this has all been very interesting. I just don't know. I've not seen anything. The guess of evidence says, what do Edom my Jews have anything to do with habeas corpus? Well, I don't know what that's about.
What does guest 11 have it to do with anything?
Okay.
So no questions? Okay, well, I guess I'll continue on then. You know, yeah, I would like, if anybody is not clear on anything, to, you know, the difficult part, like I say, you've got to get rid of your preconceptions and misconceptions to really understand habeas corpus. There's a question. Are you saying that habeas corpus is a form of individual nullification? Yes, it is. And as you follow this through, you'll see that and to the, your CI's comment, when we get to where we are now with the habeas corpus for Larry Michael Myers, you'll begin to understand this. So hold those questions. But yes, it is a form of individual nullification because if the nexus, constitutional nexus, does not exist, the person has to be released. And that's exactly where we are. But like I say, we'll go into detail on that when we get to the current case. So the next case we have is Henry Lane, and it's an 1890 case. It's 135 U.S. 443. Let's see. The law that...
You're sounding good, Gary.
What?
You're sounding real good. This is Charles Stewart.
Hey, Charles.
Yeah, you got good research there. Go ahead and take a breather. You deserve it.
We'll ask some questions just so I can do it. I got to brief myself on Henry Lane real quick.
All right. You keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, Charles. Charles is an old friend from back in 93 or 94.
Well, Charles butted heads
a few times, but we still respect each other.
Charles has spoken out often on this. The James Madison Community Call, and he's welcome here anytime.
You allow him on your show?
If you have any, well, sure. if you want to have a comment or two, while Gary's taking a bit of a break, you know, you're welcome to.
Well, I can tell Gary's running like a marathon runner there, but he's sounding real good, and I've got nothing to add. His research on habeas corpus sounds rock solid, and actually it's more in-depth than anything I got on habeas corpus there. So, you know, I'm glad to listen. It's a good refresher for me, man.
Okay, now, so the next case, then, we'll go on. It takes a while sometimes to sort these cases out. There's so many that I had to research. It's in Reed Lane, and the site is, if I didn't give it already, is 135 U.S. 443, and it's an 1890 decision. Charles Mason Lane was tried for something that occurred in the Oklahoma Territory. Now, Oklahoma Territory was not a state at that time. It had no legislative, executive, or judicial branch of government. However, judicially, it came under the Kansas Circuit. And, District Court of the United States and for the District of Kansas. The charge was on or about the fourth day of July in the year of our Lord, 1889, at that part of the district of the judicial district of Kansas, aforesaid, the same being a place and district of country under the exclusive jurisdiction of the United States and within the exclusive jurisdiction of this court, with force of arms in and upon Frances M. Skeed, a female under the age of 16, then and there being violently and feloniously did make an assault on her, the said Frances M. Skeed, and then there forcibly and against her will feloniously did ravish and carnally know her. So he raped her, and she was a minor. Now, he was charged under federal law, and he argued that, no, I should be charged under Kansas law, because Kansas law apparently was not as rigid. That wasn't covered in the case. So the question, now, you know, I remember earlier I said there's two things, challenge the constitutionality of the law and challenge jurisdiction, the venue, whether there was jurisdiction over that matter, and this one has to do with jurisdiction, territorial jurisdiction or venue. The law in which Lane was alleged to be in violation reads, the Act of Congress approved February 9, 1889, and then a cite, under which defendant is indicted and convicted, and this is after trial, it's not it was an error on habeas corpus, I think, on this one, is provided that every person who shall carnally and unlawfully know any female under the age of 16 or shall be accessory to such carnal and unlawful knowledge before the fact, comma, in the District of Columbia or other place, comma, except the territories, comma, of which the United States has exclusive jurisdiction, comma, or any vessel within the admiralty or maritime jurisdiction of the United States, comma, and out of the jurisdiction of any state or territory. Now, the issue was here, he said, I want to be under Kansas law, and they said no, because you're not in the state. The governments have an executive, a legislative, and a judicial system. They have the powers which all these departments of government have exercised, which are conferred upon them by an act of Congress. That act of Congress is the acceptance of the Constitution and the admission to statehood. So Congress relinquishes the authority granted by the state Constitution as far as its power to, I don't want to use the term rule, to govern over its people. So, but Congress did retain in Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2, power to dispose of and make all needed rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. Well, Oklahoma Territory, the Indian Territory, belonged to the United States. It did not belong to a state, so there was venue jurisdiction. There was not competition with Kansas State, even though it was in the Kansas Judicial District. So this is the venue jurisdiction that's also necessary, and both elements are necessary. And we'll get back to that with, let's see, I think I passed something. I need to back up just a minute. Somebody wants to talk for a minute.
So we'll let you back up. We don't have a problem with that.
Yeah, he did air though, but
that's okay.
I mean, might have to revisit it, but it's enacted in 1825, and I might have to go back and bring it up later. If I don't find it real quick, I'm just going to go on and we'll pick it up, like I say, later.
Okay,
next comes a famous case, and this is an interesting case because I read it a few times many years ago, but I read it more recently in doing this habeas corpus research, and I found some astounding things that weren't the focus that I was looking for the first time. One was his description of who we the people are, and there's an article that I wrote called, it's a series, a rather extensive article called We the People, But Who Are We?, which is worth reading because, you know, if absent a change in the Constitution that changes things, and 14th Amendment did not, then the definition of who the people of this country are was set out in Dred Scott v. Stanford. But another important aspect was, too, Dred Scott had been a slave. He was a freed slave, and he was mishandled by Sanford, and his wife was mishandled. So it went to court. Let's see. Where was the court that it went to? Well, whatever state they were in. It went to court, and Sanford won, and Dred Scott appealed to the United States Supreme Court. And it's Dred Scott v. Stanford, 60 U.S. 393 in 1856. The interesting part here is Stanford, when Dred Scott filed with the United States Supreme Court, Sanford did not object. Back then, a freed slave had no right to go to court on the federal level. He had no rights in the federal court. In fact, most states would not even allow a black man to be a witness against a white man in court. But as they said in the case, the defendant, Sanford, waived his defense by pleading over and thereby admitted the jurisdiction of the court. So Sanford had no, Dred Scott had no authority, but Sanford did not object timely. And once he started pleading, filing motions with the court said, okay, we'll take the case. Now, that's interesting. So if I don't challenge jurisdiction when I go to court, now there's this old theory back in the 80s and 90s that don't go before the bar. That's the rail in the court, because if you do, you're in their court. Not quite true. It appears to be more the fact that if you plead, if you file any motions with the court, unless they are to challenge jurisdiction, you have acquiesced, and the court has every right, according to Dred Scott v. Sanford, to say, okay, you have admitted to the jurisdiction of the court, therefore we will hear the matter before us. So keep that in mind. If you don't challenge timely, now remember I told you Larry Michael Myers filed with the sheriff and then mailed it to, tried to give it to the jailers and then mailed it to the sheriff before he went to court. He challenged jurisdiction before he walked in the courtroom. Now, he did give me a power of attorney regarding habeas corpus. He went to trial, but to me that trial is invalid, and that's what we're arguing at the Supreme Court. Now, let's go to the 14th Amendment, what it says. Let's see. I think we'll get to that 1825 Act here. Yeah, somewhere. Let's see. No. The 14th Amendment, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, all persons born or naturalized in the United States, comma, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, comma, both have to be requisite, are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. Now, from Barron versus Baltimore and from Henry Tarble, Barron versus Baltimore, we found that Baltimore and Barron were not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States because it had nothing to do with the Constitution. The Fourth Amendment did not apply. It couldn't be imposed on the city of Baltimore. It couldn't be used to protect Barron, because they were not within the jurisdiction of the United States. And let me go back and read 14 again. All persons born or naturalized in the United States, comma, and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, comma, are citizens of the United States and the state wherein they reside. So what effect does that have with somebody that is not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States? Is it possible that some people were not? Well, you know, it's kind of at this point kind of a difficult question. It kind of appears that way. Is there anything that supports the contention that they were not, that certain people were not subject to the jurisdiction of the United States and therefore were not wrapped up in this 14th Amendment citizen issue? Well, this is a case from 1908. It's called Twining versus State of New Jersey. It's 211 U.S. 78. Now, this is 40 years later. After the 14th Amendment, Twining versus State of New Jersey, 211 U.S. 78. Now, what happened in this case is under New Jersey law, Twining and Cordell, his partner, were running a business, and the state came in and said, "We want to see your books." "Well, I don't want to give them to you." "You have to." So they turned the books over, and they were duly convicted by the state of New Jersey for violation of certain crimes. So they went to the Supreme Court, asserting their federal rights. Justice Moody provided the decision of the court. "In order to bring themselves within the protection of the Constitution, it is incumbent on the defendants to prove two propositions. First, that exemption from compulsory self-incrimination is guaranteed by the federal Constitution against impairment by the states. And second, if it be so guaranteed, that the exemption was in fact impaired on the case at bar. The first proposition naturally presents itself for earlier consideration. If the right here asserted is not a federal right, that is the end of the case. We have no authority to go further to determine whether the state court has erred in the interpretation and enforcement of its own laws." Now, Twining and Cordell acknowledged in court that they were citizens of New Jersey. So just like in Barron, the court said, "Sorry, we can't help you." Had they been 14th Amendment citizens, the due process afforded by the 14th Amendment would have extended to them. But being state citizens, it did not. Now, wait a minute. So if I'm a federal citizen, they could have protected me from being forced to turn over my records? But if I'm a state citizen, the federal government cannot intrude into my relationship with my state. Now, you got rid of this preconceptions and misconceptions, I hope, because think of the ramifications of that. Are there two classes of people in this country that all think, according to Taney and admission to the court, all think that there's only one class of citizen in this country and we're all subject to federal jurisdiction? Or are there still two? 40 years after the 14th Amendment, there were still two. And I've seen nothing happen to the Constitution since then that would change that. Now, we'll get into how it kind of disappeared, but it didn't. Actually, it got obfuscated. I think that's the proper legal term for what happened. And that has to do with the United States Supreme Court decision in 1936. Justice Brandeis, a very reputable justice in most people's eyes. The case was Ashwander versus Tennessee Valley Authority. It's 297 U.S. 288. It was 1936. Brandeis had a separate but concurring decision. Now, we've seen Scalia come out and say some rather interesting things recently. Whether he was concurring or dissenting, he wants to say his piece. Now, Brandeis did this because he's concurring. But he says, now, he's got seven items here, and I've kind of abbreviated them. They are the words there, but I'm not going to read the entire as he presented it. I'm leaving sites out and other things, but the significant parts will be heard. The court developed for its own governance in the cases confessedly within its jurisdiction a series of rules under which it has avoided passing upon a large part of all the constitutional questions pressed upon it for decision. They are. Now, did you get that? They've established these rules to avoid the constitutional question. The rules. Number one, the court will not pass upon the constitutionality of legislation in a friendly, non-adversary proceeding, declining because to decide such question is legitimate only in the last resort. So, one, you can't take a law to them and say, is this constitutional? Two, the court will not anticipate a question of constitutional law in advance of the necessity of deciding it. It is not the habit of this court to decide questions of constitutional nature unless absolutely necessary to a decision in the case. Three, the court will not formulate a rule of constitutional law broader than is required by the precise facts to which it is to be applied. Four, the court will not pass upon a constitutional question, although properly presented by the record, if there is also present some other ground upon which the case may be disposed. So you can ask for a constitutional answer, but if they can sidestep that answer, and then he continues on that one, this rule has found most varied application. Thus, if a case can be decided on either of two grounds, one involving a constitutional question, the other question of statutory construction or general law, the court will decide only on the latter, the statutory or general law. Five, the court will not pass upon the validity of a statute upon complaint of one who fails to show that he is injured by its operation. Now, this came up recently with the lady that was, I don't remember the charges, but it went to the Supreme Court, but she could not apply to the Supreme Court until they took her to prison. And it was last year, I think, because she had to be injured by its operation. And it had to do with, I think it was some drug thing, I'm not sure. But until she was in prison, she could not challenge it. Among the many applications of this rule, none is more striking than the denial of the right of challenge to one who lacks a personal or property right. Thus, the challenge by public official interested only in the performance of his official duties will not be entertained. Let me read that last part again. Thus, the challenge by a public official interested only in the performance of his official duties will not be entertained. So if I'm a guard in a prison camp in Germany, and I think it's unconstitutional, excuse me, I'm going to have to switch phones because my battery's dying. Then since I have, let's see, Thus, the challenge by a public official interested only in the performance of his official duties will not be entertained. So a guard in Dachau could not go to the court and say, hey, we're not doing the right thing, because he's just doing his duty. And that's the fifth one. Sixth, the court will not pass upon the constitutionality of a statute at the instance of one who has availed himself of its benefits. Well, let's go back to the Internal Revenue Service. Let's see, I fill out a W-4. How many dependents do I want? Let's see, I want them to take more money or less money. I'll put three dependents down. Mr. Internal Revenue Service, would you give me the benefit of giving some money back? And down below that, you sign under penalty of perjury is true. That's how I've avoided income tax. That aspect of Ashwander I understood back in 84. The court will not pass upon the constitutionality of a statute at the instance of one who has availed himself of its benefits. So anytime you seek a benefit from a government agency, throw the Constitution away. Now you're bound by the rules of the agency, and the rules of the agency don't have to conform to the Constitution. They're made under different authorities. Seven, when the validity of an act of Congress is drawn in question, and even if a serious doubt of constitutionality is raised, it is a cardinal principle that this court will first ascertain whether a construction of the statute is fairly possible by which the question may be avoided. So there's seven reasons that we get all these Supreme Court decisions. We assume they're based upon the Constitution, but in fact, they're not. They focus on a single point, and to give you a good example, the DOMA case. What was the administrative agency that was the statutory law, the administrative agency that was involved in DOMA? Anybody want to type IRS in the chat? Remember, it was over taxes. It was over $368,000 that she had to pay because the government wasn't allowed to recognize her as married. So we can see that decisions of the court aren't necessarily constitutional. We take them as such, and I would suggest that most attorneys probably think that they are dealing with the constitutionality, but from what I've just read you, and we see the administrative agency being IRS and the DOMA, maybe we've been looking in the wrong direction. Okay, then that was in 1936. Now, in 1946... Damn, same year I was born. There was an Administrative Procedure Act of 1946. Now, administrative agencies existed since the early part of the 20th century, and some of them were referred to in the Ashwander decision. But here, come along in 1946, we're going to do something. We're Congress, and we're going to do something. Quick quiz. How many branches of government are there in the government? Answer, three, right? Anybody dispute that? Okay, we'll go with three. From the Congressional Record, March 12, 1946, and this is Pat McCarran, a Democrat from Nevada. Damn, Democrats from Nevada, they aren't nice guys. We have set up a fourth order in the tripartite plan of government, which was initiated by the founding fathers of our democracy. They set up the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, but since that time, we have set up a fourth dimension, if I may so term it, which is now popularly known as administrative in nature. So we have the legislative, the executive, the judicial, and the administrative. Damn, we have four branches of government by the enactment of the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946. These rules and regulations, I'm just reading excerpts from the Congressional Record, and this is what's called legislative intent. What they say when they do this is called legislative intent, what their purpose is. These rules and regulations are the very thing that impinge upon, curb, or permit the citizen who is touched by law, as every citizen of this democracy is. But then he goes on and says, the hundreds of thousands of Americans whose affairs are controlled or regulated in one way or another by agencies of the federal government, it is designed to provide guarantees of due process in administrative procedure. The hundreds of thousands of Americans whose affairs are controlled or regulated in one way or another by agencies of the federal government. Let's say 900,000, just for the sake of discussion, 900,000, because he didn't say millions. The population in 1946 at this time was 141 million people. So So that's less, way less than 1% of the people were affected by administrative agencies when they enacted this law in 1946. Right now, I would suppose that probably 99.9% of the people have been duped into submitting to those administrative agencies because they're there, because we don't challenge jurisdiction, and we proceed assuming with the misconceptions or preconceptions that we've been raised with. The subject of the administrative law and procedure is not expressly mentioned in the Constitution, and there is no recognizable body of such law as there is for the courts in the judicial code. Problems of administrative law and procedure have been increased and aggravated by the continued growth of the government, particularly in the executive branch. That, again, is from Congressional Record. So my conclusion then is whenever we're dealing with the federal government, whether we realize it or not, we're probably dealing with an administrative agency, and if they charge us with a crime and we enter that courtroom and don't challenge jurisdiction, we have acquiesced, as Tanny said, we have pled over and admitted to the jurisdiction of the court. Now, that's the concept behind the habeas corpus, and now I'm going to have to find that 1825 law real quick. In 1825, Congress, to protect their property, enacted a law that made it criminal to damage government property, but only in certain circumstances. An act more effectually to provide for the punishment of certain crimes against the United States and for other purposes. March 3rd, 1825. Quoting from the law, the statute, that if any person or persons within any fort, dockyard, navy yard, arsenal, armory, or magazine, the site whereof is ceded to and under the jurisdiction of the United States, or on a site of any lighthouse or other needful building belonging to the United States, the site whereof is ceded to them and under their jurisdiction, as aforesaid shall be. So in 1825, when they wrote this law, as they did in that Henry Lane, remember that was the territorial one. It only applied in certain areas. And here in 1825, Congress said, we're passing a law that will punish crimes committed against the United States if we have the site ceded and the jurisdiction ceded to the United States. So now we've got this whole question. We've got both cases. One, we've got the venue. The venue is established. It has to be ceded and jurisdiction ceded. And then they're both separate issues. And then we have the ability to apply a law under the authority of Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution, exclusive legislative jurisdiction. So that's the 1825 Act that acknowledged. Now, it raises one question, and that question is, when they stopped writing in these qualifiers like they did in that rape law, where it only applied these areas, or in that 1825 law, where it only applied to these areas where jurisdiction was ceded, and the territory didn't need to be because it was given directly by the Constitution and there was no legislative, executive, or judicial. But in forts, magazines, arsenals, and other needful buildings in the 10 square miles known as Washington, D.C., since they came out of other states, they had to be ceded and jurisdiction ceded. Otherwise, there were no laws. Now, were they just being free with their words then in putting out these qualifiers? Or should we understand that under the Constitution, they knew that those qualifiers were absolutely necessary to be included within the law Because that was the limitation of jurisdiction granted by the Constitution. So I'm believe the second, and they've just gotten lazy or tried to obfuscate their jurisdiction. So now we come to now. In trying to prove this, I filed habeas corpuses with the district court, the sheriff, and now with the warden where Leary's detained in Texas, and the United States Supreme Court. And I'm also included all those parties listed before as co-respondents because they violated their responsibility regarding habeas corpus, and they should pay Leary Michael Myers £100 each for not responding according to the law. The United States Supreme Court last November, I first submitted to them, has been going back and forth. They said, you're a layman. Only an attorney can submit this, or Leary Michael Myers. I proved them wrong on that, a case called Whitmore versus Arkansas. And I don't know if I have a site handy on Whitmore versus Arkansas, but Whitmore versus Arkansas was a guy that was not interested in the case. He just wanted to file habeas corpus, and the court went on to say, no, he couldn't. You have to have an interest. You have to know the person. He has to want to. Well, I have a power of attorney from Leary Michael Myers, so therefore he must want me to speak on his behalf. And so they have acquiesced and allowed me in. Now, if people were paying attention just recently, just a few days ago, the Supreme Court passed new rules, and they're trying to keep out lay people. The last time a lay person was heard orally in front of the Supreme Court was 1968. I hope that will change. Now, but after 7 submittals to the Supreme Court on June 29th, it was docketed to the Supreme Court. Now, the problem is it's docketed to the Supreme Court. I've directed it to Justice Scalia because he's the Fifth Circuit Justice, and Leary's in the Fifth Circuit, and habeas corpus is the ones that I find were all submitted to a single justice, unless they came on certiorari or error. They went to a single justice, and so I'm trying to get the single justice, and the rules, the statutes, and history prove my point. So I've just sent a letter to this clerk there. But the wall I've run into at the Supreme Court is first Redmond K. Barnes, second, I forgot his first name, a guy named Travers, and third is Jeffrey Adkins, who is the supervisor of new cases. And these guys, you know, they'll send me the whole package back, and then I'll do a little research and send it back to them, and they'll acquiesce on these points. So slowly I'm getting through this battle, but it's given me a perspective on this habeas corpus. Now, I don't know what the outcome is going to be. Everything you've heard so far is my opinion, and I hope I'm right. But the technical battle, getting before the court, was finally won when I received a letter just a few days ago saying they docketed the case. I finally got past the clerks. I was stopped at the clerks, the sheriffs, the wardens, and everybody else all the way through, but finally got past the clerks to a judge or to a court. The second battle now appears to be a political battle where they're going to try and jerk things around and make them appear what they are not. For example, they won't let it go to a single justice, but they have to, and that's what one of the issues of my most recent letter to them, which just went out yesterday. And the other one is they changed the style of the case. I called it Henry Leary Michael Myers because he's the demandant, the one that wants to go before the court. But with all these machinations over you don't have a right to represent him, I ended up putting my the style in the case as I put it down. Gary Hunt, friends, next friend in friends, comma, on behalf of Leary Michael Myers. Now that would to me mean that Leary Michael Myers was the demandant, but he restyled the case in re Gary Hunt instead of Henry Leary Michael Myers, so I've asked him to change that as well. But I see a battle coming here on trying to get it to a single justice and get it properly styled. It's not about me. It's about Leary Michael Myers. That's the political side. But once we get through this, then the third and final battle is the legal battle. And if it goes to Scalia, I'm expecting that we will get a favorable decision from Scalia, and he'll probably let Larry Michael Myers out of prison. So that's the habeas corpus story at this point. It's not done yet. The information, there's a bunch of links posted there if you want to read about it. You know, I've gone over this stuff, and I appreciate what Charles just said. I respect Charles, and we've had butted heads before, but if he thinks that I've done a good job researching this, and I do, between the two of us, I think I've probably done a good job researching it, and we just have to see what the outcome will be. And I can't find any cases that contradict the conclusions that I've come to in the research. So now we got to go elsewhere. Where do we go? Okay, do we have any questions now? Guess we've got to wake James up again.
You're sounding good there, Gary.
Well, that's it. We're out of habeas corpus. An hour and a half and we're through it.